Evening. Buyer's remorse. Buy a new car? I'll be moving in. Let's get started.
Sorry, I think there's been a mistake. I bought it from Carvana.
You what?
Yeah, great price. I even have 7 days to love it or return it.
So there's no...
No buyer's remorse. More like buyer's rejoice.
I guess I'll let myself out. Congratulations. I mean it.
Buyer's rejoice. Buy your car today on Carvana.
Limitations and exclusions may apply. See our 7-day return policy at Carvana.com.
Fallen Idols, 12 Statues That Made History is the new book out by Alex von Tunzelmann. In 2020, statues around the world were pulled down in extraordinary scenes from the States to the UK to Canada, South Africa, the Caribbean, India, Bangladesh and New Zealand. Black Lives Matter protests defaced and hauled down statues of slaveholders, Confederates, Imperialists. Colston was hurled into the harbour in Bristol. It was quite an extraordinary period of time. Statues are one of the most visible and controversial form of storytelling, historically speaking. Fallen Idols looks at 12 statues in modern history and why they were put up, what they represent, and how these stories are being challenged. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from the UK, I think, Alex von Tunzelmann. Alex, good morning to you.
Good morning, Giles. Thanks for having me on the show.
Pleasure is all mine. Statues. I mean, when I was a small boy, admittedly several thousand years ago, growing up, a sort of statue was something, you know, was something you'd see, you know, in a public square representing some person you didn't know much about. Maybe it was a local history thing, normally quite boring. You didn't really give them a second glance. Suddenly, last year, statues were front page news.
Absolutely. Suddenly they became this huge contentious battlefield. And what I wanted to show is that that's actually happened a few times in history, because I think a lot of people were very surprised by it. And what was very new last year is that this was really global. But of course, it has happened before. You know, for instance, the fall of communism, lots and lots of statues came down. Then that became very contentious. Then going back, the French Revolution, the English Reformation. So there have been these big waves before of people suddenly kind of smashing up lots of public art. But as I say, 2020, I think it just surprised a lot of people because it was so different. So I wanted to kind of look at that in a historical context and really ask what these things mean to us and why they become so controversial.
I mean, without getting all, you know, sort of deep and meaningful on a Monday, why do we put up statues? Why do you think victors? I mean, because obviously it's always the victors. Is it a sign of look how great we are? Look how great our leader was. Is it a sign of appreciation? Perhaps just after, you know, the Napoleonic Wars, perhaps, or after, you know, after the Second World War. Why do we feel the need to put up statues?
Well, there definitely are some different motivations. So, I mean, in a sense, our tradition dates back to ancient Greece, where they would put up what they called an icon, which, of course, our modern word icon is based on that, which was basically a kind of figure of an honourable member of the community that everybody admired. And that would be sort of, you know, treated as a sort of emblem of the community. So that started in ancient Greece. And then people just started putting up their own, you know, just if they had a family member they liked or whatever, they'd just whack one up just, you know, to kind of big their own family up. And yeah. So that sort of happened again at various points. So again, that happened in Victorian times. People started putting up these honourable, you know, portraits for public admiration to kind of, you know, inspire people or make a certain case for morals. And then, of course, what we've seen is in the 20th century, a lot of dictators and tyrants putting them up to glorify themselves. So there's lots of different motives going on.
And I mean, also, I mean, it's interesting because if you look across to the States, there was this huge debate, you know, over the past 5 years or so about the Confederate statues and what they meant. And when they were put up, you know, Robert E. Lee statues, Confederate generals, well-known and not so well-known. I mean, presumably that was just to honour their military prowess.
Well, in the States, it's a bit more complicated with that particular move because most Confederate statues were put up a long, long time after the Civil War. You know, that's in kind of the mid-19th century was the Civil War. Most of these statues went up actually in the 1900 to 1920. So much later, you know, when most of the people that could remember it were already really quite elderly or, you know, even had passed on. So really, that was part of a different movement. It was actually kind of quite specifically put up as a sort of resurgence of I mean, what they literally called white supremacy. I'm not imposing some woke word on this. If you look in New Orleans, they actually engraved those specific words on their monuments at the time, saying that, you know, that these people had saved their state for white supremacy. So, you know, it was actually kind of quite a specific move with Confederate statues to try and kind of reimpose, along with what were called Jim Crow laws, a form of segregation in the United States.
And over in the former Soviet Union, I suppose, and we talk about dictators putting up statues, and many of us remember the Saddam Hussein statue when that was toppled, and that was seen as a big moment, what, 20 years ago now, I suppose, when that big one was toppled in Baghdad. But many of these large, imposing statues really sort of mean, you know, we're in power. If you think of the Soviet pictures, you know, the Soviet statues of Lenin, to a certain extent Stalin, and all those, you know, those if you've got a taste for the Soviet aesthetic of you know, construct, you know, workers and military men looking towards, purposely, you know, and striding forwards, I mean, they were really reinforcing an ideal for first, or, you know, reinforcing that man on Superman ideal, and B, saying, you know, especially pictures of Lenin, you know, this is to what we aim.
Absolutely. And I mean, you know, those huge Stalin statues that went up kind of in, you know, under his rule in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, you know, were really intended to intimidate people. You know, they were intended almost to be that, you know, as George Orwell said, Big Brother is watching you, was to put a big figure of him in every town so that he was looking over your shoulder at all times. And you can see something similar potentially happening in North Korea now, for instance. And it's very hard to get accurate figures on anything that's happening in North Korea, but it appears that there are literally thousands of statues, for instance, of the current, you know, the sort of Kim dynasty, these dictators that have ruled North Korea for a long time. And again, you know, I think a lot of these, there are so many of them that there's possibly kind of, you know, one for every 3 square kilometers or something completely insane. And, you know, one day it's possible, of course, those will come down too. Certainly Stalin's statues did. A lot of those were taken down after he died in the 50s and 60s.
So is pulling down statues and making a displeasure, or daubing them with paint, or writing graffiti, or just generally putting a traffic cone on their head, is this, if you're from Glasgow, you know what that means, is this a new thing, you know, taking out your frustrations on some sort of social architecture?
No, it's an extremely old thing. Actually, the history of pulling down statues is almost as old as the history of putting them up. Even if you look back to ancient Egypt, it was extremely common for pharaohs to smash the statues of their predecessor and put their own up to establish their own legitimacy and avoid kind of rival claims to the throne. And as I say, it happens again and again in history. We've certainly seen it from a lot of religious movements. I mean, of course, people have been struck by the Taliban and ISIS in recent years, but actually, of course, lots of Christian movements also did this, Puritans, the English Reformation, the Lollards and so on, because, of course, the Bible actually mandates the destruction of statues. It says in Deuteronomy that you shall smash up their fallen idol, their graven idols, you know, so actually, lots of religious movements have really taken against statues. And certainly in terms of, I mean, what I find quite fun are these creative alterations. As you say, the traffic cone on the head in Glasgow is pretty harmless to the statue. And I think, you know, those statues like that, as you said, Charles, a lot of us grow up in towns with statues kind of that we barely see and barely notice. And for instance, that statue outside Glasgow Art Museum, I don't think anyone would look twice at it if it didn't have a traffic cone on its head. It's probably much more interesting for the fact it does, you know. And I think these creative alterations like that can be rather a good way of dealing with kind of older unwanted statuary. There have been some very creative plans about that. I mean, for instance, after the fall of communism in Germany, there's one artist who suggested, rather than removing Lenin statues, just grow vines over them so that they're gradually sort of swallowed up by nature, which is a very romantic and poetic way to deal with history that you want to slowly forget.
And there was, I think there was somebody in the former Soviet Union, I don't know if it was the Ukraine or the, one of the Baltic states, with their Soviet, you know, the Soviet era, so supermen and women striding purposely forward, and they'd been repainted to be the cast of the Avengers, which I thought was absolutely superb.
I mean, that's excellent, isn't it? Yeah. You know, these creative solutions are brilliant. There was one in Ukraine in 2015. Of course, there was a big wave of pulling down Lenin statues. It was actually called the Lenin Fall. It was, so many statues of Lenin were pulled down. But the one that I really liked is the one that they took him with his big billowing greatcoat, and some brilliant artist used some fiberglass to turn it into a perfect Darth Vader.
Oh, yes.
Which
yes,
was
absolutely.
So clever. And you can look it up online. It's very, very funny. You know, and I mean, I'm all for these witty approaches. I think this is a very good solution to the issue.
I'm talking to you, obviously, we broadcast from Spain, and there has been, after the Civil War, in 36 or 39, there was a, what were they called, the Pact of Forgetting, and we didn't mention what had gone on before. And now, since the re-establishment of democracy, since 75, there has been a policy of removing any sort of memorabilia of the dictatorship, and that includes statues, not only of Franco, but also various generals, taking down street names, etc. That, you know, how important do you think that is, removing, and we talk about the former Soviet Union and bloc countries as well, how important is it, do you think, to remove these statues so that, you know, democracy can get on and living their lives? Because otherwise, isn't there a danger they become focal points for fringe groups?
Yes, there is. And I mean, that's why, so after World War II, for instance, absolutely all Nazi statuary was removed in Germany and actually criminalised. You know, you can't display the swastika in Germany these days. And that was part of a de-radicalisation process. And I think, you know, most people now, whatever their feelings on what should have happened last year or what went on then, would probably say that was the right decision. You know, it'd be very, very hurtful for lots of, say, Jewish citizens in modern Germany to have to walk past Nazi statuary. It would obviously be, you know, very painful to have that. And absolutely, you're right, they do become focuses for fringe groups. And again, that's what's happened in the US with some Confederate statues. I think one of the reasons those are so contentious is that actually quite a few of them have become rallying points for instance, the Ku Klux Klan and other organisations from sort of the 1970s onwards. And, you know, obviously, that's sort of, you know, you can't claim this thing as a neutral historical object if it clearly isn't to a lot of people who have a very strong political agenda. So that's when sort of, you know, there has to be this discussion really about what you do with a statue in that situation.
And again, the other thing is that people who perhaps wouldn't even look twice at the statue, didn't even notice. Last year when, for example, the Colston statue went into the water off, you know, off Bristol and that big thing, and suddenly, you know, we had one side saying, oh, well, this is wokeness. This is BL, you know, this is Black Lives Matter. We're going to stand against this. And you had literally groups of people guarding statues. And it's interesting because perhaps these, you know, the people who were guarding these statues, who were getting so heated about them, you know, before that wouldn't have batted an eyelid about it. They probably walk past them every day of the week.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, you know, the minute it becomes controversial, then both sides realise it upsets the other side. Then, of course, they all dig in and start doing it much more. And I mean, I think that's sort of what's been happening a bit. And there's a great deal of tension in the UK. You know, there's anxiety, should we say, in the UK about things like Churchill's statue in Parliament Square, which did have some graffiti put on it last year, but not for the first time. I mean, that statue has been graffitied at least twice before as well, in various protests and circumstances. One time actually by a British Army veteran who really disapproved of Churchill. And so, you know, but it becomes contentious because, of course, the minute that, you know, the kind of progressive side, shall we say, realises it upsets the Conservatives, then they, of course, go for it more. The minute the Conservatives realise it upsets the Progressives, then they go for it more too and start defending the statues. And it becomes sort of very hyped up. And I suppose that's really what I'm trying to do in the book, is cut through that a bit and say, well, look, you know, let's all take a bit of a step back and actually think about this in a broader way. And of course, we can have, you know, community discussions and so on about what we do with these things and perhaps consider it slightly more calmly.
So how do you pick 12 statues then? I mean, you know, if you like your top 12, you know, is almost like the pop charts. But what, you know, what sort of, are we talking the broad sweep of history? Because otherwise you could very easily go on the 12 statues that have made history, you know, in the past 10 years, especially in the past sort of 5 years or even the past 24 months. So how did you whittle it down to 12?
My God, you could do 12 in the past week. I mean, have you seen in this week, even in Latin America, they've been pulling down Columbus statues, and Canada, they've been, you know, hauling down British monarchs and all sorts of things. It was really hard to pick 12, to be honest, because there are so many stories I couldn't tell. But what I was trying to show is, first of all, sort of starting with the American Revolution, where famously they kicked off the American Revolution by pulling down a statue of George Washington. George Washington's troops pulling down a statue of King George George III. But yes, it does. George Washington's own statues have been pulled down in 2020. But yeah, I wanted to start then partly because it's, again, challenging the idea that I think we've sort of got a bit entrenched in 2020 with thinking that statues are, you know, patriotic and conservative and so on, and that, you know, pulling them down is kind of anti-national and all this. And actually, the American Revolution sort of shows that that's really been very different at different points in history. It matters a lot, you know, which context this happened in and who was doing it and what the statue meant. These cases are all very different. But yeah, I wanted to make sure I ranged with the 12 all over the world. So deliberately, yes, there's the Soviet Union, there is Latin America, there's Africa, there's India, and as well as Europe and North America. I wanted to make sure that I really took a global point of view and looked at some challenging and difficult cases. But one crucial thing actually is that all the statues are of men. And the reason for that is that the vast majority of statues are of men. And of course that is changing now, but historically it's certainly been the case.
I mean, do you think that we still need to put statues up? I mean, there is a plinth and Trafalgar Square that isn't, last time I remember reading about it, they were debating what to put on it, and there was all sorts of ideas, and it should be this and it should be that. It certainly wasn't going to be another, you know, a dead white man, as the saying goes.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, and nothing against dead white men, I'm sure there's lots of very nice ones, but yes, I mean, I think in a sense, you know, the statuary that we've got mostly in the public arena is kind of largely a Victorian relic. It was very much created along with ideas of the great man theory of history. And, you know, as I say, very specifically men, the idea that history is just created by these, you know, great men or awful men who do these enormous deeds. And I think in a sense, a sort of, you know, version of history now might be a bit more sophisticated than that. We understand it's quite complicated and that people aren't simplistically heroes or villains, and that actually sometimes what changes things is, you know, is more like group efforts. And I think, you know, we've already got a great tradition of memorials that take things slightly more broadly. I mean, war memorials often do, for instance, and I think can often be extremely moving for that reason, that it's not really just about, you know, plonking one person on a column, but actually remembering a community and a collective effort, which I think a lot of people find very moving and inspiring. And of course, you know, I think we're seeing a lot more now, you know, some really wonderful creative forms of memorialization. And I certainly mention a few in the book. I think there are some brilliant ones. I mean, for instance, in Germany, the Stolpersteiner, which some people will know, these little tiny brass plaques in the pavement outside houses where victims of the Holocaust lived, that just record their name and dates and what happened to them and all of this. And I think those are amazing because there's 75,000 of them across Europe now, and you can almost just not see them. But when you start noticing them, you realise they're everywhere. And it simultaneously kind of gives you that sense of this individual tragedy for each person, but also of the horrendous scale of what happened and the Holocaust. And I think those are intensely moving, but there's not a statue in sight. You know, they're definitely a slightly more lateral creative take.
I mean, do you think that the statue debate should have triggered some thought about what statues mean to us and who these people were, rather than just saying automatically, you know, it's black or it's white, he was a slave owner, you know, he was a general, Confederate general, therefore he's a bad person, rather than saying, well, you know, we should look into the past, that we should learn from this, and we should have a debate on this, rather than just saying, oh, you know, pull it down or guard it with a bunch of, you know, guys standing around it.
Absolutely. I mean, one thing I'm really quite, you know, strong on in the book is I really want us to stop thinking about history just in terms of good or bad, heroes or villains, you know, these kind of pride or shame, these very simple binaries about history, because it really is more complicated than that. And I think, you know, the one thing that I think is a very, very, you know, positive thing to come out of last year is that actually it has opened up people's interest in history. I mean, for instance, you know, I do look a lot into Edward Colston in the book, and, you know, I think that's a history a lot of people really wouldn't have known or been very interested in if the statue had not become this point of contention and if that very dramatic pulling down hadn't happened. I'm not saying we always have to pull down statues in order to have a conversation, but, you know, at least for historians, this is a great opportunity actually to say, okay, well, let's look at these people. You know, now you've got controversies over Cecil Rhodes or Leopold II of the Belgians or whatever. Well, let's look at them. Let's look at them very honestly. And I mean, you know, and you don't have to come back to saying, oh, he was good, he was bad, or even he was a bit of both. You could just ask, what happened, how and why? These are the questions historians are really interested in, is not really your modern value judgments today, but actually looking at somebody's life and, you know, and the events of that time in a much more kind of rounded way.
And I mean, also congratulations to A, on the book, but also the front cover, because the front cover has got the picture of obviously a large Lenin statue, or just his head lying sort of abandoned in a patch of ground somewhere. And if I always find those Soviet ones that have been pulled down and they just left, there's something oddly poignant about them, because if you grew up as a child in the 70s and the 80s, or a teenager in the 80s, the Soviet Union was this huge, we were going to be against the Soviet Union forever, that's what we could see, and those statues in public places and that whole atom punk Soviet, that Soviet look was seemed immovable. And yet now we see with them with weeds and grass and vines growing over. And there is something sort of oddly poignant about that.
Absolutely. Well, something that I think is a brilliant solution to difficult statues is the idea of sculpture parks, or what are sometimes called statue graveyards. And there is a brilliant one in Moscow. They are also in Budapest and in Baltic states. And there's one in Delhi in India for British statues and so on. And essentially, if you move the statues to a park like that, the one in Moscow is amazing because they're all sort of jumbled in together. And some of them are broken, Stalin's had his nose smashed off and all of this, but that lets you sort of see it in a real context. It tells you the story of the history, but also of people's reaction to the history and all of that. And I think that's, that could be a very interesting solution for those of us in the UK and the US, is to think about these kind of outdoor parks where you can put them. And, some of them do end up, as you say, neglected with vines growing over them. Some of them end up, the one in Budapest is actually really beautifully tended and, really very well organized. But both of those parks tell interesting stories about history. And a great day out, sure, to take your kids and learn about what happened.
The book is called Fallen Idols. It's by Alex von Tuzelmann. Alex, if people want to find out more information about you or the book itself, do you have a website? Is there social media?
Sure. My name is a pain to spell, but you can find me at www.alexvontunzelmann.com. Hopefully it comes up if you just do Alex Von T or something and it'll turn up. Or on Twitter at Alex V Tunzelmann. I will be there to chat about statues pretty much all the time.
And the book is also available as a virtual download from our bookstore. Just a quick final question. Do you have a favourite fallen statue? Is there a fallen statue that you will think, I'd quite like to still be back up there, or you just think, in its resting place now, it sort of brings a wry smile to your face?
Yeah, I think actually the fallen ones, as I say, can be quite, there's a quote from an art historian who says that if, is a statue on its side, does that automatically become sculpture? As in, does it then become a piece of art rather than propaganda? Does that elevate it? And I think there's some quite wonderful ones like that for sure. I mean, I'm quite, one that I do find very poignant is the statue of George V in Delhi, which used to sit right in the centre of town under this big arch, and now has been moved out to this bit of scrubland in North Delhi where it's largely ignored and sort of surrounded by local kids playing cricket and people hanging out there washing and taking selfies and so on. And I think the sort of gradual crumbling of it in its context is sort of remarkable. It tells you a real story about, about Indians' attitude to their British imperial history, that it's not kind of, they haven't torn it down or smashed it up. They're just sort of gradually letting it fade back into dust. And there's something very poignant about that.
Absolutely. This book is called Fallen Idols, 12 Statues That Made History. It's by Alex von Tunzelmann. Find them on Alex von T and they'll pop up on your whatever search. Alex, it's been a real pleasure to speak to you today.
Thank you so much, Charles. Take care.